John chapter 13 at verse 1. Jesus washes his disciples' feet. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel round his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand." "No," said Peter, "you shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." Then Lord Simon replied, "Not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Jesus answered, "A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean, and you are clean, though not every one of you." For he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said, "Not everyone was clean." When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I have done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." So we've been unpacking our core values as Christians and as Baptists since our covenant service. If you were here on Wednesday night, you've got a little bit of background about why that is. But it's good, strong stuff, and it's a real challenge. We've seen in recent weeks that actually we have no control over what other people think about us. You know, Jesus says, "You're like those children in the marketplace. You know, we played the flute, you wouldn't dance. We sang a dirge, you wouldn't weep." And then you go on and you say, "Oh, John the Baptist, he comes and he's all stern and mean. He's got a demon." And then I come along and I'm friendly and I get on with people, and you say I'm a drunkard. You know, basically, the first thing that we learned is that we have no control whatsoever over what people think or say about us. So we can be free and give that up. What a relief. What a relief that is. And Jesus said, "Actually, do you know what? I came as a doctor for sick people, not the people who think that they're well." He came as a friend of sinners, which is good news for people like us. But the people that wanted to be right in their own eyes, they just couldn't get along with him, because he just kept wrong-footing them. He kept popping the bubble, didn't he? That he wouldn't kind of let them get away with it. He was just truthful. And love shone through at their intentions and motives as well. So if we want to be an inclusive church, we have to give up our perceived reputation and instead be like Jesus. We want to be a Christian church. We want to be certainly a Baptist church, but it's about being a Jesus church. And last week we actually saw that it goes further than that. If we're going to live as God's people, we're going to have to go against the flow. I mean, Jesus did, didn't he? And who were his greatest enemies? The people in power, the people with reputation, the people with status, the people thought that they were the bee's knees, who wanted a status quo. And so we also need to realise that certainly as a Baptist denomination, dissent is part of our DNA. We have to speak up. We talk about that as being a prophetic, or seeking to be a prophetic community as well as inclusive. And sometimes that means that we will be thought of as bigots, perhaps even as lawbreakers. And we saw that cartoon last week about the changing attitudes towards God's word. That by the end, if we say, I believe the Bible is the word of God, we're tarred as bigots, or even being accused of hate speech, because we say something as radical and as exclusive as Jesus is the way, the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through him. Well, that's a really very exclusive thing, isn't it? Take it up with Jesus is the answer. It's not our fight. We just know that that is true. And if people try and tell us otherwise, then as we saw last week with Peter and John in front of the Sanhedrin, when they said, now stop preaching in this name, you're making us look bad. Peter and John turned around and said, well, you decide for yourselves who we should obey. Should we obey man or should we obey God? Let's think about that for a moment. It doesn't take long, does it? We need to obey God, even if man tries to stop us. And we saw by the end of last week that our world is going in a direction that means there will be a sharper and more clear decision to be made. And so now, let's move on to this week. We're thinking about serving, but we're thinking about serving in a particular kind of way. I'm not going to suggest that all of a sudden we start foot washing, because culturally that's not really our thing. We don't walk around barefoot in sandy areas like they did in Israel. So I think we're going to apply it in a slightly broader sense and just think about serving. Serving is a really important thing for our spiritual life. I was reading about some monks, you know, the sort of Desert Fathers. If you've heard of the Desert Fathers, I love their writings. But different monks and ascetics and different people sort of early on in Christianity went out into the desert. You know, that be ye separate, come out from among them, which we thought about a few weeks ago. Their way of understanding that was to quite literally withdraw and go out into the wilderness, to be away from the marketplace, away from temptation and away from the world. What they found was that they took themselves with them, and so they just faced a different kind of temptation. But one of the things that comes up repeatedly in their writings, obviously, isn't going to be lust for money or goods, because they don't see them. They've renounced those things. But what they did find was a sin that is called acedia, boredom, apathy, where they just kind of lose their momentum. Spiritual inertia, where there isn't that challenge that forces you to draw on God. And so you just kind of start spinning your wheels a little bit. It just becomes a bit samey. And we get bored. We get complacent. And I was thinking, you know, that is part of the problem with the church. Not this church, but I'm talking about the church, you know, the church in the 21st century. And it's a peculiar phenomenon. And I initially thought about it from a parenting point of view. You know, one of the byproducts of the good parenting that we're all encouraged to do in this last generation or so is we try and be really good parents. And there's no shortage of food. There's no shortage of education. There is TV, there's computers, there's social media. And all those things that, you know, at our fingertips, we have so much information, so much worthy stuff to engage with. Do we? Probably not all the time. And in fact, you look at the generation of younger people and you see that rather than becoming more resourceful and connected, as was the intention behind those things, research and our experience shows that actually, without difficulty, we create a generation of poor copers. People that don't have the resilience and the resourcefulness, the robustness that comes from demand and from challenge. Isn't that interesting? And that's true spiritually. And it's not a difficult thing to change. You know, historically, one of the most toxic things that ever happened to Christianity was it became accepted by the Roman Empire. Got mixed up with state and power. And one of the worst things that ever happened to the Baptist movement is that it became respectable. You know, you go back and you look at characters like Smythe who had to flee the country because they went and got themselves baptized as adults. You know, there was a really clear kind of movement of conviction, a movement of dissent saying, this is what my conscience says. This is what the Word of God says. This is what the Holy Spirit is saying to me now. I must obey God rather than man. And then over time, we become respectable. Everything's okay. And we start to worry about our reputation. Oh dear. You see, reputation and following God, at some point, they're going to part company, and we need to make a decision. Because the kind of persecution, the kind of difficulty that we encounter in our society at the moment is one of discomfort rather than how it would be perhaps in Somalia or North Korea. You know, here we have, you know, sort of less. And yet, you look in Galatians, for example, and you realize that Paul had fully understood that you can't please God and people at the same time. You know, in Galatians chapter 2, he goes and he rebukes Peter, the apostle Peter. You know, Peter the rock and all that kind of stuff that is said about him. Peter, in chapter 2 of Galatians, read it for yourself later on, had compromised. He'd flaked out. He'd started to soft pedal the gospel of grace to the Gentiles. Why? Because some Jewish people had come from Jerusalem and were visiting, and he didn't want to look bad. He wanted to be in with everyone. If you're following Jesus, give it up. You will not be in with everyone. You just won't. Not even religious people. Not even respectable people. You know, we need to understand really very clearly that our society is changing, and if we are going to be a Jesus church, we need to embrace that challenge. Listen to what Paul writes to the Galatians in chapter 1. He says, am I striving to please people? If I were still trying to please people, I would not be a servant of Christ. Interesting. And so there we bring in serving. Just there. He's just saying, if you want to serve Christ, power serve. If you want to serve Christ, then you cannot worry about pleasing people. That's kind of point number one. The philosopher Seneca told a metaphor of a tree. I'm coming round. We'll get there. He said Seneca told this metaphor of a tree, and I think it's useful and helpful. He says, and he's talking about difficulty. He says, why then do you wonder that good men are shaken in order that they may grow strong? No tree becomes rooted and sturdy unless many a wind assails it. For by its very tossing, it tightens its grip and plants its roots more securely. The fragile trees are those that have grown in a sunny valley. If we have shelter, if we have everything, we become weak, and it's not actually good for us. So, question number one. Are you comfortable in your spiritual life? Do you have any challenge? Are you actually suffering from acedia? Are you perhaps a little bored? When you read the Acts of the Apostles and then you look back over last week's journal, do you see any similarity at all? Because if there was one thing that you can say about the early church, some people loved them. Some people hated them. But nobody ignored them. They didn't say, oh yeah, they're nice. We need to see clearly that as time moves forward, as our society changes, we have to pray that we will be serving God in a way that isn't worried about pleasing man. It's about pleasing God. That's really important. I think Satan's greatest success in the West has been to facilitate a church without backbone, because we've grown in a sunny valley. We've not had the trouble that would give us strength, that would force us to throw ourselves in desperation on God, that would force us to put our roots down deep. Now, you might say, so Ian, are you saying I should go around and provoke persecution? Honestly, don't do that. It'll come. It's going to happen. What I'm saying is that when slipsis, that pressure, you know, the squeeze that we've talked about before, when that pressure comes, it's not a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. It shows us what's on the inside, and it forces us onto God, onto one another, that we support and serve one another, just the way that we should do. So don't go looking for it. It'll come. And I want to say, just before we kind of get into looking at this passage, one other thing. I personally hold Disney responsible for valley mentality, for spiritual and emotional weakness, because they have trained us to expect a happy ending. You know, that there's going to be a thing, set up, oh, something a little bit scary, happy ending, credits roll, and then the blooper reel or whatever like that. But essentially, have you ever had your life work out like that? I mean, one of the things that I like about The Princess Bride, if you've ever read the book, The Princess Bride, William Goldman, it's in the film. If you watch the film by Hollywood, it ends with them, Wesley and Princess Buttercup, riding off into the sunset. And it's lovely. In the book, the boy who's sort of reading it says, it was a happy end, you know, is that the end? And he goes, oh, no. He says, because there's no such thing as a happy ending while the characters are alive. He says, then this happened and this happened and this happened. It's a brilliant book, and it's a fantastic ending, because it says, life's not like that. You know, when you're doing wedding prep and all those things, it all builds up to this lovely day, and the day is lovely. But then there's Monday, and there's bills, and there's children. Oh, my word. I'm saying, don't chase persecution. It will come for you. Okay, so you know what I'm saying. Life goes on. There isn't a Disney ending. One of the stories that when I was director of Evangelism Explosion in this country, James Kennedy, who was the guy who started it all, pastor of a massive, massive church in the States, very conservative evangelical, very respectable, very straight down the line, you know, a moral majority kind of church. And sort of back in the early noughties, a militant group, a militant gay group, had sort of said, we want you to marry us here. And he said no. It was only a setup. They just wanted an excuse, an occasion to go and march around with banners and protest against him. They didn't really want to get married in his church. But what was interesting, so there's all these people with placards saying bigot and all this kind of thing. And it was a day a bit like today. It was cold, but they were marching around and the cameras were there and everything like that. James Kennedy waited until the cameramen had gone out, you know, gone for their kind of bacon roll and cup of coffee because it was so cold. And he went out with trays of hot drinks to give to the protesters. And when he went back in, one of his associates sort of said, oh, what did you say to them? Were you trying to persuade them to go away? He's like, no. Evangelism explosion. Were you trying to convert them? No. Well, what were you doing? I just thought they'd be cold and thirsty. He wasn't looking for a Disney ending. He just wanted to serve. Because everyone's got a right to disagree, haven't they? I think as soon as we start, particularly as a church, as soon as the church starts saying, you're not allowed to disagree with us, then we're back to the Inquisition, aren't we? We're coupling faith with the wrong kind of power. And so we need to not fall into that trap. Let's not fall into the Disney trap. I mean, it would be lovely, wouldn't it, if he took the coffee out and they all said, we've been so mean. We'll go away and we're going to think about our lives and we're all going to become Christians and be nice. Think about the passage. Jesus washes Judas's feet. Does he know what Judas is going to do? Of course he does. So does he think, well, I'm not going to wash Judas's feet because he's a wrong un? Does he make a distinction between who to serve and who not to, based on their kind of moral code or integrity? Not at all. He actually knows that Judas, with his newly cleaned feet, is going to go trotting off to the temple to sell him out. Doesn't he? Jesus isn't worried about a Disney ending. Is he? Because you think about what happens next in his life. Jesus isn't thinking about a Disney ending. We serve and we want closure. We want a happy ending. We want people to feel helped. We want people to feel grateful. We particularly want people to say that they feel grateful. And it's really nice if they'll tell other people about how grateful they are that we served humbly, without judgment. Because we're complicated and brilliant, but we're also a little bit wrong as well. Jesus washed Judas's feet. Jesus washed Peter's feet. You know, I mean, he got a reaction from Peter, didn't he? Peter's immediately proud. I'm not going to let you wash my feet. You're the master. I'm not. You know, and so sometimes when serving happens, it brings a real reaction out of us as well. It brings that kind of, I don't want you to serve me. I'm really guilty of that. If you were here on Wednesday night and heard what I was saying about my situation and the way that we've been, you know that I've got that wrong in the past. I'm trying to put that right. But we need to recognise that we need to serve one another without any kind of judgment, without any kind of expectation of a happy ending. And also we need to allow ourselves to be served. And that's not always easy. So we're not to judge who is worthy to be served, but to serve them with our eyes wide open. Jesus knew that Judas was going to betray him, but that didn't stop him serving. So why would we serve? Well, first of all, Jesus said so. He tells us to serve, obey. And we've said before, if he's Lord, then we're not. We do what he says. It really is as simple as that. It's not easy, but it is simple. Secondly, we serve because Jesus has first served us. We seek to help others because Jesus has helped us. We seek to lift others because Jesus has lifted us. But you look at Jesus and you say, well, isn't that a little bit demeaning? I mean, he's the rabbi. I mean, he's the Son of God. And they cottoned onto it by now. And yet he does this thing. Isn't that demeaning? Isn't that a little bit belittling? But you look at verses 3 and 4, and it's something really interesting. It says, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going back to God, so he rose from supper and laid aside his outer garments. So he rose. Can you see that? He knew who he was. He knew who his Father was. He knew that he was doing the work that God wanted him to do, and he knew that he was going home. So he was free to take on a demeaning role. He was free to serve. It didn't matter. And he says later on in the same book, as the Father sent me, so I send you. We are sent to truth tell, to serve, to be misunderstood, to be taken advantage of, to be betrayed, to be denied. That's okay. We're not doing it in that sense for the thank you, for the Disney ending. We're doing it, we're serving by faith, not because we see the results, but because Jesus said, I've done this, you do this. That's what it's all about. And we know that we've got a heavenly home. We're all just walking one another home, aren't we? So let's share and serve while we do it. Will the world love us for it? Most of the time, no. Will we get a happy ending? Most of the time, no. I think one of the things that mislead us and trips us up is sometimes we go into a Christian bookshop and we read a testimony book of someone who did something and then their life changed. And that's great. Does that happen all the time? No. In fact, what it does is it raises our expectations so that we then feel disappointed if we just serve by faith. Can you see? It actually distorts us to wanting a Disney ending. Whereas actually what I want is reality. What I want is obedience. What I want is an opportunity to love. You know, one of the most toxic things is boredom. Is church being the same. Church being comfortable. Church being respectable. It's not that edgy, exciting, unpredictable, sometimes dangerous adventure of discipleship that Jesus called his people to. Jesus knew that Judas would use his feet to run to the temple. Jesus knew that Peter would use his feet to stand near a fire and deny that he ever met him. Jesus knew also that what he was doing was setting the most powerful example that we would follow in his steps. I've just got two quotes. First is from G.K. Chesterton. I love this quote. I think I've put it on Facebook a couple of times. G.K. Chesterton simply said this: Jesus promised his disciples three things. That they would be completely fearless. That they would be absurdly happy. That they would be in constant trouble. Use that as a helpful checklist for how you're doing this week. It's an interesting one because actually the first two seem to go hand in hand with the third one. That we would be completely fearless, absurdly happy, and in constant trouble. Jesus put it a different way. He said, if anyone wants to follow after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. So I want us, just before we sing our final song, to be quiet and make a decision to serve, not to care what other people think. Jesus wants to free us from a good reputation. He wants to free us so that we can live the greatest adventure and have our lives count for eternity. And the byproduct is you'll never be bored again.